for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Barack Obama vows to double funding for cancer research within 5 years if he's president. If John McCain wins the White House, he promises to ensure doctors and scientists have appropriate levels of research funding to fight the disease. Dr. Bernadine Healy joins me to talk about how a new president could help make cancer a curable or manageable disease within decades with strategic thinking and targeted investment. She's health editor for U.S. News & World Report, author of the book titled Living Time, and, of course, former director of the National Institutes of Health. You can join us throughout the hour, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Dr. Healy, it's so good to see you again.
Wonderful to see you again, Diane.
It's been quite a while. You were diagnosed back in 1999 on Valentine's Day with a malignant brain tumor. Tell us what happened.
Well, first I have to tell you, I don't like to talk about it too much. I did write a book about it. Now that's behind me. But I think most people who have gone through this don't like to recount it. But to answer your question specifically, it is something that all physicians see and work with and understand. But when illness hits you directly, you're just like everyone else. You're all the same in a hospital, Johnny. And having had the experience as a cardiologist, having had the experience in another field, was certainly a shaking one, a difficult one, but it only reinforced what already was a substantial commitment that I had in the area of cancer research. When I was head of NIH, it was the 20th anniversary of the National Cancer Act, of the War on Cancer. We're now almost at 40 years. A lot has happened, but we don't have a cure yet, Diane, and I think that's why we all have to be urgent about this.
You actually had a seizure, which was the first indication that something was wrong?
Well, I think that in many cases when people have cancer, it just comes out of the blue. They're feeling perfectly well, and then suddenly there is one symptom that pops up.
And that was what happened?
And that's what happened, and it often happens with that particular kind of tumor. And then you find yourself a patient after thinking yourself totally healthy. And that's one of the sad things for all people who have cancer. So often it hits when they're in the prime of life, when they're feeling perfectly healthy, and when they have done everything that they think is going to keep them healthy forever. And life does deal these strange things to you. But you know, Diane, virtually everybody is touched by cancer. Either directly themselves, about 40% of people, but also through their families.
Of course.
Cancer is a family effort. It's a family disease.
One last question about your own health. How are you today?
I am feeling great, and I'm delighted to be here on Election Day because the cancer movement, no doubt, has always been influenced by presidents, the Cancer Act. The War on Cancer was started by a Republican president, President Nixon, and every president since has taken this on as a very special issue.
Why do you believe that this is such a critical moment in the war against cancer?
It is critical because now we finally have insights, the epiphany, if you will, that will lead us to the answers of cancer and the epiphany, and that is understanding the fact that cancer is a genetic disease and those genes are the blueprint for cancer. Unless you have an understanding of that roadmap or that blueprint, you're treating cancer in the dark, and that's what we've been doing for all of time. We know it grows fast, we go after fast-growing cells, but we have not understood what is the underlying mechanism, what makes one cancer behave one way, another way, look somewhat different, look the same, and yet surprise you. So this is a magical time in our understanding of cancer. It is the beginning of a long road. It is also a beginning of telling us that maybe we were on some wrong tracks in the past.
Hmm. So you're basically talking about the mapping of the genome and what that has given us in the way of new information.
Well, the mapping of the human genome, which was a grand accomplishment of this country and many other scientists throughout the world, and it really helped unlock the secrets of the normal healthy person, you know, the 20,000 plus genes that we have that define who we are and also define the differences that we have, you know, one person's blue eyes, another person's brown eyes. But what it also did is set the stage for understanding a genetic disease that causes an illness or a problem. And, of course, cancer is the quintessential disease of genes. That doesn't mean you inherit it. You might inherit 5% of a tendency for cancer. But most of the genetic disease that is cancer is something we acquire throughout our life. But nonetheless, it's genes gone wrong, genes in that cancer cell that almost turn it into another species that goes at odds with the healthy cells in our body.
So you're saying that the cancer genome is a cell gone haywire.
That's correct. And that cell goes haywire because its genes have gone haywire.
Hmm.
If that cell had a normal nucleus, normal genes, it would not be a cancer cell. And virtually all of the bizarre things that cancer cells do, the fact that they grow faster than they should, the fact that they spread throughout the body, the fact that they can set up housekeeping in an organ far away from where they originally started, that all is directed by the genes deep within the nucleus of that cell.
Now, there's something called the Cancer Genome Atlas Project. Tell us about that.
The Cancer Genome Atlas Project, which was started in 2006, is an exciting effort on the part of the National Institutes of Health, including the National Genome Effort as well as the National Cancer Institute. And what it is doing is it is setting out to map the complete genome of individual cancers.
Mm.
And what we've learned up until now, as we have gotten more and more genetic information, in part over the past 10 years because of mapping of the normal genome, what we've learned is that cancers that we have thought to be identical and yet behave so oddly. I mean, I think anyone knows of a patient who gets a diagnosis of breast cancer very early on. They're treated. It looks like they're doing fine, and then a year later it comes back. Another person looks like they have the exact same form of breast cancer. They go on forever and are cured. What is the difference? And what the Cancer Atlas is doing is it's looking at several hundred tumors that are all carrying the same label, whether it's ovarian cancer, lung cancer, breast cancer, and then it looks at their information source within the cell, their genetic makeup. And no surprise, we found out that identical tumors look the same under the microscope, to a clinician's eye look the same, and yet they can be very, very different. And within that genome, we see genes that explain aggressiveness or explain why someone else's tumor is a very gentle, quiet tumor that kind of perks along and never gives them a problem.
Dr. Bernadine Healy, she's health editor for U.S. News and World Report and author of Living Time, Faith and Facts to Transform Your Cancer Journey. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. So here we are, shortly after November 1st, and in September, researchers reported the project's first findings. What were they?
Well, in September, first of all, I should say Atlas started with a so-called pilot. They decided to choose three tumors to see if it would work, to see if they could move quickly, to see if the value, there was value to the information. And they started with lung cancer, ovarian cancer, and brain cancer, a particular one called glioblastoma, which is the one that Senator Kennedy has been fighting of late. In September, they announced the result, the first results of the ATLAS, and it was for glioblastoma, and it showed lots of surprises. Hmm. So the pilot has proven correct. It showed three gene pathways that they had no idea were present in glioblastoma. It also showed information on why glioblastoma seemed to be so resistant to chemotherapy, and some information also about possible drugs that might be useful. The exciting thing about finding these blueprints and actually decoding the whole genome is you find surprises like, aha, this pathway has gone wild. Well, wait a minute. We know this pathway can be blocked by a drug that we use for kidney cancer. So you would never... So you're using the information to direct therapy rather than just throw drugs at patients, all the same type, and hope for the best. So it causes a directed therapy, a personalized therapy that we had never imagined. And I think glioblastomas are now going to be treated better and differently because of this kind of information.
You've used the analogy of several cars arriving at a single garage.
Yes, actually, my dear colleague, Katie Hobson, who wrote a wonderful piece accompanying mine, in which she used that wonderful analogy. And it is like lots of cars on a road, and they can use the same different pathways. They can use different pathways, but all get to the same place. They all look like cancer, the same place as that cancer. But they may have a different favorite way to get there. And what you need to know is which way it is for that patient and then block it.
Dr. Bernadine Healy, health editor for U.S. News and World Report. We'll take a short break, but do join us, 800-433-8850. Welcome back. Dr. Bernadine Healy is with me. Of course, she's been on this program with me many, many times over the years as she was director of National Institutes of Health. She is now the health editor for U.S. News and World Report. This is an interesting question. Please ask Dr. Healy if privacy concerns about publishing the results of individuals' genome by a Google-funded company called 23andMe could inhibit folks from getting their own genome.
Well, Diane, privacy has always been a concern about as part of the Human Genome Project, and it transcends cancer. But if you have a gene for cancer, a family history that you're concerned about, you might want to have that information, but you don't want anyone else to have it. But that also goes if you have a gene that predisposes you to Alzheimer's disease or to heart disease. Just recently, this past congressional session, a bill called GINA, which is the Genetic Privacy Act, was passed after many, many years. I mean, it's been on the books or it's been trying to be passed for, 15 years, but it was finally passed, and it makes it illegal basically, for someone's genetic information to be shared inappropriately. That is your private information. And I think that when a company is using a genome, presumably this particular company that's mentioned, it is doing it anonymously. In other words, that it is not identifying the patient's name. A patient should have access, their doctor should have access, but like anything else in your medical records, it needs to be kept private.
At the same time, there would be, I would assume, concerns about a prospective employer getting hold of such information.
And that's really the heart of the legislation called GINA, and that is that an employer cannot discriminate if they cannot force an employee to have a genetic test, and they cannot use such information were it to be in their keeping in any way against them. Because, you know, some places there is access to people's medical record, you know, providing health care. I mean, most employers do provide health care through insurance companies. And it is illegal to share that with the employer, and more importantly, if it is available, to use that against anyone.
Dr. Healy, the question that many people ask is, can we know at birth what we may encounter 20, 30, 40, 50 years down the line?
Well, I think understanding our genomes will tell us about susceptibility. And it is important to know that it is susceptibility. In the area of cancer, for example, you can be born with certain genes that make you more susceptible to getting cancer. For example, we all know about the breast cancer genes, BRCA1, BRCA2, and they do make those who carry that gene more susceptible to breast cancer, in some cases to ovarian cancer, to colon cancer, and if men have it, to prostate cancer. But because you're susceptible does not mean that you are going to get it, because cancer is not just one gene going bad. It is many, many genes going bad. However, Diane, in the course of all of our lives, we are exposed to the environment.
Of course.
We don't know what's in the environment.
We're also
exposed to accidents. Remember, our cells are constantly reproducing. And just think about how many times you make a spelling error when you're at your computer. Well, the body has ways to try and correct those errors, but it doesn't always do it perfectly. And that's what we call mutations. So you may be born with a genetic predisposition, but you have to have in the course of your life other mutations, other genetic changes that then trigger the cancer.
Now, what about Huntington's chorea? Is there a pretty definite signal for that within the human genome?
Yes, there are certain diseases that in which all you need is to have one genetic profile, and it is almost certain that you are, or you'll have a 50% chance of getting it if you don't actually know whether you carry the gene. For example, it's called a dominant gene, and half of the offspring would have it, half wouldn't. With genetic information, you'll know exactly if you're in the half that has the gene. But cancers are not like that. Cancers require multiple genetic mistakes. It's not just one gene. It's a whole genome of a cell that is transformed by cancer. That's what makes it so complicated. That's what's made it so mysterious, Diane. That's what's led to so many mistakes in the way we've been treating it blindly in the past. And that's also its hope for tomorrow.
Just before the break, you said how wonderful that we are where we are, but how sad that it's taken us this long to get here. To what extent is the cutback in funds for the National Institutes of Health in part the problem?
I think it wasn't ever a cutback. What it was is for several years.
Lack of growth.
Right. It was the lack of growth. I think that growth is part of it, but as importantly, it is making sure that growth is used strategically, not just used in yesterday's patterns. I think that you get to a certain time in the history of an idea or of a scientific development where you really need to move very quickly in certain areas, and maybe maybe reallocate from other areas. And I think that right now we have a robust and phenomenally exciting basic research enterprise that must be supported, but in certain areas. Certain areas better than others. Scientists don't like to hear that. They think that any idea they have is equal to anybody else's, just depending upon how clever they are. Well, we are at a moment in time with cancer where both the basic research as well as the research that gets information into drugs and into treatments that make a difference in people's lives, they both need to move hand in hand, but in a very, very strategic and targeted way. And I think at least some of the money that is going to be allocated with a doubling of the National Cancer Institute budget over the next several years, which I'm optimistic about, it can't be just given in an indiscriminate way. I think it does have to be more targeted.
Let's talk about cancer stem cells, what they are, and how important they may be.
Well, the cancer stem cell, some people will call it the cancer stem cell theory. I think increasingly people are saying, wow. And this is one of those wow moments, because over the past several years, it's become apparent that certain tumors, like the leukemias, lymphomas, breast cancer, and also brain cancer, are triggered by what's called a tumor-initiating cell. It's a very primitive-looking cell, and it's a stem cell, and we've heard a lot about stem cells, the stem cells that help repair our bodies, the stem cells that are there at the birth and evolution of the embryo. But this is a stem cell gone bad, just like a cancer cell goes bad. But it is a primitive one, and it appears to be the stem cell initiates the tumor and lurks quietly, is resistant to most of our treatments, and it has qualities like the ability to roam about the body because of its primitive nature, to more easily take up residence in distant parts of the body.
Could you see such movement?
Well, in time we will, but the problem with stem cells and why it probably hasn't been developed or discovered until more recently is that they're present in such tiny amounts. Maybe 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 5,000 cells might be a stem cell. So that you can think you're having a great success. You see a lung tumor and you see it shrink, almost disappear. But those stem cells are still lurking. So you think you've had a success, you think you've had a cure, and then a few years later, it appears again. And that's believed to be because of stem cells. Sometimes they can lurk in the body for 10, 20, 30 years, and for whatever reason, whether it's the immune system changes, the environment of the body changes, and suddenly that cancer comes back. So stem cells are very important if we're going to understand not just that primary tumor, you know, the first time you discover the tumor, but the tumor that starts to spread, the tumor that comes back, and the tumor that disseminates throughout the body. That is how we will make a difference in cancer. Diane, of the 500,000 people that die of cancer every year in this country, most of them die because that disease has become metastatic. It's gone beyond that primary site and spread through the body. Cancer stem cells is a chance at knowing what to do to prevent that from happening. If all we had was that little tumor lurking in the breast, or we had a little tumor in the lung and it never went anywhere, we wouldn't have a problem with this disease. It would be like having a mole that just sits there and doesn't do anything.
But when you've got restrictions on certain kinds of research, doesn't that put you at a disadvantage?
Well, you know, there's an exciting paradox here, and that is a lot of money has gone into stem cells because of the controversy. And a lot of money the controversy was about embryonic stem cells.
Right.
But adult stem cells, all of us have stem cells in every organ in our body, and they're part of repair, they're part of restoration. The fact is that a lot of money went into adult stem cells because they're not ethically challenged, so to speak.
Right.
So all this money that went into adult stem cells, some of it was used to suddenly study, discover, understand the cancer stem cell. So I would say that the controversy over stem cells has had a huge payoff in our understanding of cancer and cancer stem cells.
Do you see a future president, a future Congress, moving toward greater accessibility for doctors to embryonic stem cells?
I suspect that that issue is not going to be what it's been in the past several years. I think that most of the Congress, I think both of the candidates, would be supportive of stem cells. But what has happened is science has almost jumped over the need.
Yeah.
If anything, the what you want are the adult stem cells because they're the ones that are like you. You don't have to. They're not transplants. If you're going to manipulate a stem cell, if you're going to understand a cancer stem cell, they're the ones that are, they're personalized. There's nothing more personalized than your stem cell. So I think that this issue is not going to be an issue as it has been in the past several years, both politically, but also scientifically.
One last question before we open the phones. How close might we be to a vaccine against cancer?
Well, you touch on something which is critically important, and that is it's not just the tumor growing in an organ, but it's how your body responds to that tumor. And one of the most powerful things we have to defend ourselves is our immune system. And vaccines are about using your immune system to fight off disease. And, of course, we know about it with polio and with, you know, childhood vaccinations. But with cancer, the notion of using a vaccine, which usually is something that uses some element of your own tumor to stimulate certain killer cells, which are white cells that will go after that tumor, to activate that system in a way that it could actually cause that tumor to melt away. And we've seen examples of this. Dr. Rosenberg at the NIH has been working on this for years. There was recently a report out in from California in which patients with malignant melanoma were studied with a cancer vaccine, and at least in a few of them, there was a dramatic response.
Interesting.
Prostate cancer. So I think that we just haven't found the answer to make it work reliably, but we've seen some exciting results in some cases.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Dr. Bernadine Healy is health editor for U.S. News and World Report. She is, of course, the former director of the National Institutes of Health. And we'll go to the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Boca Raton, Florida. Good morning, Claude. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane, and good morning, Doc. It's wonderful to hear both of you on this topic. You know, I don't have cancer, but my mother died of cancer over 40 years ago. But, you know, I don't see I having any, but I don't know if I can have it. I have two friends that died from cancer. One right now go through surgery three times for kidney cancer. They take out one of his kidney, and they put him on chemo, and, you know, they keep chemo on him for a year. Then they up the dosage, and the doses, you know, burn through his colon. Then they go back to the normal. So one minute he's good, next minute he's bad. I don't know. Is there any kind of cure even for breast cancer? My mother died for so long from it. I started by breast cancer stamp, trying to help all these ladies. You know, and it just made me wonder if my daughter going to wind up with it, or my wife going to wind up with it. You know, and I'm trying to do what I can do to help the research. And this is going on for years and years.
Long time. You're quite right, Claude. What's the future for breast cancer, Dr. Healy?
I think what Claude is expressing is something that I mentioned earlier, that everyone is touched by cancer, whether it's themselves or a loved one. No one escapes it in the course of their life. And I think when you have a loved one who has gone through it, you know it like no one else knows it. In terms of breast cancer, there has been an enormous amount of investment in breast cancer over the past 20 years, and we really have made great strides in that arena. But breast cancer, like almost any other cancer, once it becomes metastatic, that is, once it spreads to the liver or spreads to the bone, whether it's breast cancer or prostate cancer or colon cancer, they all behave the same, and they have a very dim prognosis. At that stage, we try and use chemotherapy, sometimes radiation therapy, but so far we have not succeeded in dealing with that stage of cancer, its most advanced stage. However, there's some optimism. Look at a Lance Armstrong who had metastatic cancer. It was in his brain. It was in his belly. It was in his chest. Spread from his from a testicular cancer, and he was cured. Now, that's an unusual tumor. We do have a way to cure testicular cancer. My hope, my belief is if you can do it for testicular cancer, you can do it for any cancer. You just have to figure out what the right drug is to do it. And the right drug is going to be something targeted. And Claude, I think that's sort of what you've expressed. I mean, chemo can have so many side effects. Radiation can have so many side effects. But tomorrow's medicine is going to be very targeted to that particular gene and how that gene is dysfunctioning. And that'll make tomorrow's treatment more humane, but also more effective.
You're so optimistic, and that optimism, I hope, is conveyed to those like Claude who have been touched by cancer. Dr. Bernadine Healy is with me, and we'll take just a short break here. When we come back, more of your calls, your email. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by this and other NPR stations, by the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, announcing Kids Count, a state-by-state look at child well-being and juvenile justice reform at aecf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Dion returns to the show to perform songs from his new CD, which features his covers of early rock and roll classics. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Well, now sing me all the way down there. Come on, let's go, little darling. Let's go again once
Welcome back. We'll go back to the phones. Let's go to Mary Jo, who's in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
Diane, I adore your show.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Your perseverance, Dr. Healy. I'm fascinated with all the information you're providing. I myself am surviving stage 4 ovarian cancer.
Wow.
Good for you.
And I'm 34 months since my diagnosis.
Great.
My question for you is basically it's a mind-body connection, because I seriously believe that our perspective in life has a great amount of healing ability that we can use in healing our bodies from any disease that we're challenged with. And additionally, another piece of that is alternative therapies in conjunction with clinical protocols to protect the cell membrane and try to salvage our immune systems when we are barraging our bodies with chemotherapeutic agents. And I was wondering if you had any information that you could share with me in that light.
You know, I think this is something that anyone who is going through cancer always asks, is there something more, especially when they're up against limited options and their doctor says, well, you know, we've given you the best we have nothing more, and people look for alternatives. I happen to be one of those physicians who is extremely sympathetic to that and actually believes that someday we're going to find a scientific proof for some of the things that we often poo-poo today, like does attitude make a difference? A lot of the scientific studies that have been done say doesn't. But, you know, you just look at groups of patients, and I suspect that attitude is something that varies so much from person to person. And I do believe that there are some people where attitude really does make a difference. Maybe prayer makes a difference. Optimism makes a difference. But I'll tell you one thing. If you sit around being pessimistic, thinking you're going to die tomorrow, that's not good for you. It's not good for your family. And it robs you of the life that you have. So I'm with you. I go with you. I think that's where every patient should be. It is your living time.
And we wish you all the best, Mary Jo. Thanks for calling. Here's an email from Rick in Bethesda, Maryland, who says, Diane, anyone who would not be skeptical about hearing for the umpteenth time that we now have the tools we need to beat cancer, either isn't aware of the history of this disease over the past few decades, or they are hopelessly, blindly invested in the current paradigm of curing rather than preventing disease. Cancer is a disease that occurs in most cases after decades of damage to DNA and exposure to environmental promoters that chiefly include high-calorie diets, high in protein. Dr. Healy's insistence that this is a genetic disease will unfortunately give people the impression there's nothing they can do about prevention. Our government has done next to nothing to educate people about cancer prevention, even after research has revealed that a diet high in fruits and vegetables and whole grains is protective against the most common cancers.
Well, at first, I think you have to realize that it is not either or. It's not prevention versus treatment. You must do both. You can't walk away from someone who has cancer or walk away from someone who has advanced cancer and say, it's hopeless, goodbye, any more than you would walk away from a coronary care unit filled with people who have just had heart attacks. However, that does not mean, hand in hand, you shouldn't be working to focus on prevention as well. And anyone who has seen or understands what cancer is should be humbled and should be motivated to do what they can do to prevent cancer. And you're absolutely right. A diet is very important, a diet rich in fruits and vegetables. And I will tell you, when I was head of NIH, I traveled across the country preaching fruits and vegetables. It was five fruits and vegetables a day. And the HHS, Secretary of HHS, was there with me on occasion. So this is something we've tried to get the message out. And I know it's gone for 20 years. People are still not eating their five fruits and vegetables a day. Remember, the government can only go so far when it comes to prevention. So much of it is personal responsibility. The biggest thing, if we could stop smoking, we would suddenly cut in half the number of people who are dying because lung cancer is such a it's the major cause of death.
But let me take you back to your own situation. You are clearly a person who has cared about your diet, who has cared about your exercise, who's done everything you could because you are knowledgeable to prevent cancer. And here you had a metastatic brain.
Well, I think that's
tumor.
I think that's the important thing, and that is that you can't always prevent.
Exactly.
I mean, a woman who has, we heard from a caller before, who had ovarian cancer, we don't know what causes ovarian cancer. We don't know what causes brain cancer. We don't know what causes many lymphomas and leukemias. Look at all the children who die of cancer. So I think that to say that we can prevent all cancers, maybe someday we can. And I suspect the way we'll do it is by picking them up very, very early, maybe even before they have one symptom, before they have, could even be picked up on an x-ray or have any signs. That will be sort of equivalent, prevention, early detection. Mm. But we don't yet have the tools to pick up most cancers in their earliest phase. Most cancers, the overwhelming number, we do not have a way. Mm. And that's where things like biomarkers will become important to find something in your blood that says, whoops, you have something going on somewhere. We're going to try and figure out what it is. That does not mean, however, and your caller is so right, that everyone shouldn't think about prevention of heart disease, prevention of cancer in the way they eat, in their lifestyle. I mean, the obesity and the smoking that's going on in this country right now are two areas where we could radically decrease our chances of getting cancer. We could cut down the cancer numbers, but that does not mean that people are not going to escape cancer as a very, very serious illness and dying from cancer.
All right, let's go now to Chagrin Falls, Ohio. Good morning, Melissa. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was calling because I inherited a BRCA mutation from my father, and I found this out when I was diagnosed with breast cancer, despite the fact that my father had also died of breast cancer. So I was calling with first a comment, which is that it's really important for people to know with respect to BRCA mutations so they can be inherited from either a male or a female side of the family. And my question is, how can we help ensure that primary care physicians and OBGYNs are as educated about these issues as oncologists and genetic counselors are? Because they are really the first line of defense for patients. They're the places where people are going to find out they might have a predisposition. My oncologist and my genetics counselor know very well about this, but my other doctors did not. So I'd like to hear how we can help educate physicians better.
Well, I used to run a medical school. I was dean at Ohio State University Medical School, School of Medicine and Public Health. And I, you know, we try. And I think one of the key things is always making sure that medical curriculum gets updated, that the continuing education of the physician, which starts from the moment they graduate from medical school, is continued. And I think that every single doctor has to be aware of this, of how you can prevent and how you can pick up disease, whether it's heart disease, whether it is cancer. And you're completely right. I think the fact that you had a father who had breast cancer automatically makes one think about the risk of a BRCA mutation.
But it also makes one think, when you're talking about the education of doctors, also reminds us that a second opinion and sometimes a third opinion is not only called for, it's absolutely essential.
Well, you're right, Diane. And if you have a doctor who doesn't want you to get that second opinion, then you get rid of that doctor.
Change doctors.
But also, you know, the exciting, another exciting part of this moment in time is that patients can be as smart as their doctors, because we don't have medical knowledge locked up in medical libraries and in obscure medical textbooks. I mean, it is on the internet. And if you use reliable sites like the NIH site or the CDC site or the American Cancer Society,
you can learn so much.
There is almost nothing you can't learn.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes it's overwhelming, but if you have the right kind of doctor, you can go in and say, you know, I found out about this. Do you think that I need to have such and such? And good doctors want smart, educated patients.
Here's an email from Valerie, who says, I teach biology at the college level. When I teach my students about cell division, I teach them about cancer because, as Dr. Healy says, it unfortunately touches all our lives. I think it's important to point out to your listeners that the genes involved in cancer have normal functions within the cell. It is only when they are mutated, and it takes a number of genes to be mutated, that it can lead to cancer.
Quite right, absolutely quite right, and it's the number of genes and it are those mutations, and they can be little mutations or they can be a part of a chromosome that's whacked off. But I think that makes teaching biology a lot more exciting.
And here's another from Jane, who says, please ask Dr. Healy why other countries have not had more success in cancer research. Cannot we combine forces to solve the puzzle?
One of the great things about biomedical science is it does tend to be global. I mean, it's open to the world. The Human Genome Project was led by the United States, but it was carried out with a major global effort. And increasingly, you will see cancer research from colleagues all around the world coming out with as important and dramatic findings as what we have here. However, I think the United States has always led the way in terms of the money, the taxpayer dollars that it's willing to invest in cancer and in cancer research. And on that, I think we have helped the world. It's one of those subtle things you forget about talking about when you say, what have we done for people in other countries as American citizens? And that, I think that's one of them.
Let's now go to Statesville, North Carolina. Good morning, Tracy. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for taking my call, Diane. I'm
sure.
A big fan. And Dr. Healy, I appreciate you doing the show today. My mother was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer on June 20th of this year, and she passed away on September 20th.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Thank you. Thank you. She had been a hospice nurse for over 20 years, so she told us early on from the diagnosis, since it was stage four, she didn't expect the outcome to be good. And I was just curious, Dr. Healy, what has been done as far as early detection of pancreatic cancer? I mean, we had no warning signs at all. She worked 2 days that week and had a little trouble with her back, went in, thought they had maybe infection in gallbladder, and then the CT showed the mass in the pancreas, which metastasized to the liver. So I was just curious where we are now as far as early detection of this disease.
We are nowhere, and I'm so sorry to hear what happened. And unfortunately, this is typical of pancreatic cancer. It is also true that we don't have any risk factors. I mean, it's nothing that your mother did wrong, or, you can't say, well, and this is why, this is what gives us the sense of urgency. On a positive note, just this past month, several researchers from different centers came together and announced the pancreatic genome, pancreatic cancer genome, and roughly 63 genes are involved in that particular cancer. What it will provide, however, is information on better ways to treat it. And we have got to also find ways to detect it early. And you're right, most of the time it doesn't show up until it is advanced. Everyone needs to think about pancreatic cancer to get this imperative.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Dr. Healy, last question for you. We are voting today on a new president. How would you advise that individual as far as the war on cancer?
I think that our next president should realize the history of many presidents in the war on cancer and recognize that this is a new moment. This president has the opportunity to really take advantage of something that is quite different. We have led up to it slowly, but this is the time for us to accelerate our efforts. Do I think we're going to have a cure for cancer, or we're going to have the answers for cancer in the next 5 years or in the next 8 years? No, but I think we will be so much further ahead. This is a breaking point in terms of how quickly we can move.
Is it going to need more money?
It'll take new money, but it'll take strategically applied money. And I share the sympathy of one of our earlier callers who said, well, people are always taking bows, they're always saying, look at our discoveries. I think we really have to be strategic and say, what are the results going to be? And give us a timeline. Let's make sure we meet objectives because we have the tools now. We do have the tools, and we have comprehensive tools.
But, of course, considering the current financial situation, aren't you concerned that NIH's budget, for example, will continue to be flat?
Well, I don't think so. I think that one of the things that has happened over the years is whatever happens, NIH budget grows, and I think that the area of cancer is one of the most important areas from a public point of view. I think it has always had presidential focus by virtue of the National Cancer Act. So I'm optimistic that there will be the money. I think the doubling of the NCI budget is a smart move. However, it has to be done, again, I don't want to be redundant, it has to be done in a more strategic way, because there are some areas of opportunity right now that are greater than others. It cannot just be, we'll just distribute it equally to everybody.
Dr. Bernadine Healy, she's health editor for U.S. News and World Report. She's author of a book titled Living Time, Faith and Facts to Transform Your Cancer Journey. She is herself a recovering cancer patient. She was for years the director of the National Institutes of Health. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Diane.
Good to see you. And thanks for listening, all. Be sure to go out and vote. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.